Chapter 16. My dad has hated me for as long as I can remember. That's a pretty sweeping statement, and I know how phony it sounds. It sounds petulant and really fantastic. The kind of weapon kids always use when the old man won't come across with a car for your heavy date at the drive-in with Peggy Sue, or when he tells you that if you flunk world history the second time through, he's going to beat the living hell out of you. In this bright day and age, when everybody thinks psychology is God's gift to the poor old anally fixated human race, and even the President of the United States pops a trank before dinner, it's really a good way to get rid of those Old Testament guilts that keep creeping up our throats like the aftertaste of a bad meal we overate. If you say your father hated you as a kid, you can go out and flash the neighborhood, commit rape, or burn down the Knights of Pythias bingo parlor and still cop a plea. But it also means that no one will believe you if it's true. You're the little boy that cried wolf. And for me, it is true. Oh, nothing really stunning until after the Carlson thing. I don't think Dad himself really knew it until then. Even if you could dig to the very bottom of his motives, he'd probably say, at the most, that he was hating me for my own good. Metaphor time in the old corral. To Dad, life was like a precious antique car. Because it is both precious and irreplaceable, you keep it immaculate and in perfect running order. Once a year, you take it to the local old car show. No grease is ever allowed to foul the gasoline, no sludge to find its way into the car, her hair defiantly. Her hands were not dove-like at all. I'm not pretty. No one likes me. I never had a date. Everything she said is true. There. The words rushed out very fast, and she screwed up her face while she was saying them, as if she were taking nasty medicine. Take a little care of yourself, Tanis said, then looking embarrassed but still determined. You know, wash, shave your legs and armpits, look nice. I'm no raving beauty, but I don't stay home every weekend. You could do it. I don't know how. Some of the boys were beginning to look uneasy, but the girls were leaning forward. They looked sympathetic now, all of them. They had that confessions at the pajama party look that every male seems to know and dread. Well, Tanis began. Then she stopped and shook her head. Come back here and sit down. Pat Fitzgerald snickered. Trade secrets? That's right. Some trade, Corky Harold said. That got laughs. Irma Bates shuttled to the back of the room, where she, Tanis, Ann Lasky, and Susan Brooks started some sort of confabulation. Sylvia was talking softly with Grace, and Pigpen's eyes were crawling avidly over both of them. Ted Jones was frowning at the air. Georgianic was carving something on the top of his desk and smoking a cigarette. He looked like any busy carpenter. Most of the others were looking out the windows at the cops directing traffic and conferring in desperate-looking little huddles. I could pick out Don Grace, good old Tom Denver, and Jerry Kesserling, the traffic cop. A bell went off suddenly with a loud bray, making all of us jump. It made the cops outside jump, too. A couple of them pulled their guns. Change of classes, Bell, Harmon said. I looked at the wall clock. It was 9:50. At 9:05, I had been sitting in my seat by the window watching the squirrel. Now the squirrel was gone. Good old Tom Denver was gone. And Mrs. Underwood was really gone. I thought it over and decided I was gone, too.